We're good? Excellent. Welcome, everybody. This is a fantastic session to listen to because I find it fantastic. Let me introduce myself. My name is Frank Simmerjee. I'm with Microsoft Trustworthy Computing, and I am a product marketing manager. I won't be answering your questions, but these panelists here will. One of the things that I wanted to do before I introduce them, I also wanted to share that since these are reputable hackers, in the white hat sense, of course. One of the things I did is I went and tried to investigate to see if I could discover any hackability about them. So I'll share a little bit of that information about with you in just a second. So coming down the line, we have Andy Malone. He is an MVP, Enterprise Security Worldwide Events Speaker. And after a little bit, technology, family, traveling books. What book did you write?
It's ongoing. It's a novel.
A
Watch
novel.
Watch this space for more details.
I have it if you want to read it.
Sounds like something worth reading.
I didn't ask you, I just have it.
All right, so here's the thing that I found out about Andy. Did you know he's a Canadian actor born in Newfoundland? Anybody here from Newfoundland? No? Oh, yeah. You see, have you seen Andy in any movies? You know, according to what I discovered, he was in a movie called Lemon Cracker, the movie Bobby, and then the Huron Shores production. So how was that? Yeah.
That was a good movie, man.
Yeah, was it?
I made about $5 from that.
All right, Marcus Murray. Marcus is a security specialist, Windows-focused, obviously, MVP Enterprise Security. So TrueSec Worldwide, security team manager, lots of creds. I mean, the guy's been doing this for a long time. I know he's been doing this for a long time.
I write it myself.
Yes. Yeah, you clearly gave me great notes, by the way. Yeah. All right, so a little bit about Marcus, though. Did you know he's also a bodybuilder? Well, he started bodybuilding at age 26, and he wanted to, the comment that I found I thought was really interesting is he became a bodybuilder because he wanted to look and feel better. He also spent time in jail, I found out.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, did I also mention the fact that you're supposed to be an African-American?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I did have to change things after the jail time. So I lost weight, I changed my skin color. I did a Michael Jackson, so to speak. I mean, I'm here now.
Paula? Yeah. Now, I'm not going to butcher your name because I'm going to actually pronounce it right. Januszkiewicz.
Januszkiewicz.
All right, so I still butchered your name. Enterprise Security MVP, Trainer, MCT, Security Architect. Secure iDesign, providing consulting services for four continents, book author. All right, so what book?
TMG, Threat Management Gateway.
TMG.
Yes.
I think there's been some product changes there, haven't there?
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit.
It was a long time ago.
Research, obviously you're passionate about research. Now, you know, one of the things is that I didn't find a lot about you.
Because nobody dares to use my surname.
It's your surname. That's the problem. All right. But I did find lots of pictures. By the way, did most people know here that she's also the MVP stock photo model? That's pretty cool.
Whatever it means.
It means that you're a woman and you're in IT.
Yes. Exactly.
All right, a little louder, I guess, is the key there. All right, Mark. So Mark is a senior solutions architect with Microsoft and obviously a consultant. Now, that's all true. But you know, I also found out that you're a songwriter, singer of an album from 1995, Race the River Jordan, and also Yodel Ali. I don't know. Tell me about the song.
I don't think it appeals to this audience.
No? You sure you won't want to sing it for us?
I could, but I have to make a lot up.
All right, I won't put you on the spot. Well, anyway, during the session, we'll be following some questions that I've already discussed with my panelists. We'll take some questions from the audience, maybe towards the second half of the session. And obviously, the best place to start is BYOD, first of all. So what does BYOD mean to you guys? I mean, that's the magic question I think most of us here want to know. Because after that, they'll all leave.
So for me, bring your own device means a challenge. So that's something that is very challenging to like every customer that I talk to. And that's something that everybody brings to the field because it's pretty hard to manage all the devices that are like user-owned devices. and especially when you allow these devices to connect to corporate network. So BOD, if I could summarize it in one word, means challenge. And it's going to be challenge, it is a challenge, it was a challenge, because there's going to be always somebody that brings some geeky stuff to the company that would like to connect, use some data, copy some files, make some photos, and it also brings some problems.
Anybody else?
Age
before beauty.
Oh, absolutely. bring your own device, obviously. For me, I would say probably bring your own data to any device, because more and more now our data is in the cloud, so we want to access it through any device, hopefully securely.
Yeah, I mean...
You're biting at the chomp. Go, Marcus.
Yeah, I mean, bring your own device to me, it's the future, and it's here right now, so I think we have to accept it. I don't believe in security professionals that are trying to stop this at the gates. We have to realize that it's a change going on in the world, and we have to adjust to it. And it's not just a bad change, it's a good thing. We have access to data wherever we go. We can be more efficient. We can mix business with our lifestyle and all that stuff. We just have to figure out a way to make it work in a sense that we don't lose our important data and stuff. So I think this is a very creative and interesting time, to be honest. I don't have all the solutions, but I'm going to be very happy participating in trying to find them. So absolutely. I think it's really cool.
And I would agree. I mean, to me, the bring your own device is not just bring your own device, because these devices bring identities with them. They bring a bunch of other things with them. You lose control of the hardware layer, so you have to trust in the manufacturers or the vendors or the carriers on occasion. It really reinforces to me the need for risk management. It's no longer an absolute, you're inside the boundary or outside the boundary, and then you're secure or not secure. It's different containers, different temperatures of risk that you're willing to accept. Yeah. That's how I see it.
But just adding to that, I mean, we always, especially we non-Microsoft, we always have to trust others. I mean, we have to trust people that creates the BIOS for the hardware as well. We need to trust the guys who makes the operating system. So that's not new for us. It's just a new vendor.
All right, so the real interesting question that I have for you, how does this change the attacker's landscape? What's the new battlefield look like? I mean, this must be fantastic for the people that are actually looking to exploit equipment. So tell us about your perspective from that viewpoint. Marcus, go for it. Yes, I was looking at you.
Okay, yeah, I don't know, okay. So my take on the change in infrastructure, I think there is one big misconception about smartphones and smart devices that they necessarily have to have weaker security. That is not necessarily true. They have a different architecture, which is better in some ways and worse in some ways. I mean, the sandboxing is stronger on a, for example, iPhone than it is on a normal PC, because they made a different decision of what you can install and how much access you get to the real system or kernel of the system. There's a more controlled process on how you feed applications to the platform, which makes it more difficult for me to just send malware to your email address and make you click something and download and install it. It will go through some controls before it happens, so there are goods to it. I mean, the bad thing is obviously that it's more difficult to control them as opposed to enterprise-controlled workstations that you deploy yourself and all that stuff. So there are goods and bads. I mean, patching, it's easier on an enterprise level. It's not so easy to know whether or not you're patching your Android. We have a problem with the vendors. If you buy a Sony smartphone or a HTC or whatever you're buying, if they make this phone out of band, they may or may not keep doing the patches. So even though you have Android patches, they may not support that. So there are different problems, and we have to realize that, but it's not necessarily worse.
Andy?
I completely agree with Marcus. I mean, we're moving into a completely new area. I would say that definitely the attack vectors are moving from PCs, definitely to the phones. I mean, there's been a lot of information in the news about the attacks on Android. I mean, yes, because Android's got the biggest market share without any shadow of a doubt. So, and a lot of it is because it's open source. So open source, of course, people are going to attack that. But I think it's actually also a good thing, because it's forcing vendors to come together and actually start producing common tools, common antivirus tools, common protocols, common security methods, which is going to be a good thing.
And Microsoft brings a lot of devices, right? We've got tablets, we've got phones, and that's a geeky stuff, and people want to have it. So that creates another problem. And of course, whenever we are discussing the bring your own device thing, the security is going to be, right now, at least most of the organization, relying on whatever a user is doing with his or her laptop at home. Sometimes you've got a situation, and that's like what I see every day, when the user says like, oh, you know, I'm using my own private laptop because the one that I got is old and I cannot really work on it. And that's like a very typical situation. Of course, you can request for the new one, but sometimes it just takes time. And this is a time that, for example, let's call them hackers, can use this opportunity to maybe install something, do something on a user's desktop, and then the user brings the problems because there is no choice. So there's no other possibility. So that's the battlefield, to actually enforce security check on the user-owned devices, which is also kind of maybe politically not correct. Of course, user works for a certain company, but on the other hand, it's a user private data as well. So installing any kind of agent will not be the good decision. So on the yesterday's keynote, there was a very nice discussion related to what's going to be introduced in Windows Blue. So the control mechanisms and devices going to have their own identity, this kind of half domain joined devices that are not really in a domain, but we're allowing access to the network. That's what Microsoft brings in to the field whenever we are bringing devices. So we need to have a solution, and we will have a solution for that. So the solution is actually coming.
Let's work off of that a little bit. What would you recommend to your customers when they actually disclose the fact that they have all these different devices, potentially even older devices, on their network, older phone, older handhelds, older tablet-type devices? Is there any recommendations you give your customers? Are you worried about them bringing that equipment into their organization, especially a real, we're talking about a soup of equipment?
I think the real answer to that question, from my perspective, is we need to understand that we need to give them different level of access to data and systems depending on the trustworthiness of the platform they're working on. So if you're working in a government agency and you're going to do super secret stuff, you're going to be on the workstation. Maybe you can only access the red environment from there. If you're going to access webmail, maybe you can do it from your mobile device. It's a decision you make. So you will have to take all these different services and those data, you're going to have to start classify them and make up your mind. What can you access from your own device? What can you access from a managed external device? And what can you only access when you're internal? And I think that is the way forward. And there are,
I completely agree. I mean, the key is when you look at like just a phone device, you've got your Apples and your Microsofts of the world where there's a quality gatekeeper that says only such and such quality bar gets across and gets to run on the device. Then you have the Androids, which is kind of a mix of some of that, and some of the, just the straight out open jailbroken sort of you can run anything you want. And then even on the PCs, you know, you've got your bring your own PC, you've got the PC the corporation issued you, but truly you also have a bunch of Windows XP PCs out there that are much more vulnerable than a Windows 7 or Windows 8, especially with the hardware ties for security. So it's very, you have to really look at that whole landscape, like you said, and look at those thresholds of risk and say, where am I going to put my most valuable data? Where am I going to put my least valuable data? And you really have to view it in that kind of tiered structure or zone structure. That's really the way we look at it in our world.
I think the key thing about BYOD for me is that you're not so much controlling the device. So in days gone by, you would control how PCs were deployed. You would control how they're accessed. You can't control BYOD. You manage it. You have to manage it. In terms of the phones themselves, you need to keep them. They're an operating system, so you need to keep the OS up to date. You need to keep it virus free. But I think one important thing as well is exactly what you said. You need to keep the data completely separate from the phone. So whether you do that through access methods or whether you do it through virtualization, I think you need to obviously do a full risk assessment, first of all, on the actual phones that you're going to accept. And then deploy from there.
So, Andy, you mentioned Android exploit. I've read up a little bit about that. I believe that it exploits through a desktop, right? I mean, it's an installer. But since we're starting to see more of these, in fact, I think there is a rise for that particular platform. What would you recommend? What's the best way this audience should be dealing with the fact that that malware is on the rise? What do you do?
Don't jailbreak your phone. I mean, that's it, you know?
No, that's one thing. Yeah. I mean, I disagree with the statement that we cannot manage our phones. There are good management mobile device platforms out there.
Intune, for example.
So, I mean, MobileEye and all those other platforms. I would look at it from this perspective. I mean, if you have your own device, then you can access certain resources. If you are willing to underthrow the policy of the company and make them connect your device to the mobile device management system, and you may need to have one of these models so that you actually can be compliant from a quality perspective of updates and stuff, I mean, then you can have some data on them, maybe. I mean, sure. There is a difference. You can manage them. Another thing is antivirus. The antivirus vendors are obviously moving to the mobile platforms. You have to start to read up on what an application can do to other applications. Because there's no magic bullet for antivirus software. Because of the sandboxing, they can't see everything that's going on in the system. So they're actually just monitoring installation packages and some stuff, depending on the different flavors of, you know, Android OS, Apple OS, or Windows OS. So you need to be aware of the fact that the nice marketing doesn't always fit the real reality.
So, Paula, you have experience with this?
Just one comment to that. Regarding the management, we've got, as Marco said, many vendors that can help out to manage our mobile devices, starting from the simplest one, which is Intune, delivered by Microsoft, ending up with, can I mention vendors?
No. You can say whatever you want to.
Yeah, okay. So, for example, the vendor starting with a letter S. Antivirus.
It's fine, it's fine. Go ahead.
Nobody knows what I'm talking about. Okay, so for example, they do have...
Based in Cupertino, right?
They do have a SMM system that can do whatever Marcus was mentioning. Yeah? So antivirus solutions on a mobile device is nothing new. There are vendors, delivered systems that we can reach. So it's just enough to jump in the website, check out what is offered, what kind of phones are supported. In the vast majority of cases, it's an iPhone, Android, and of course, Windows Phone, which was not that super popular maybe some time ago, but now it's a widely used phone. So that platform is known. So that's something that is also managed by one of the vendors' solution. And many, of course, not only Mark.
Mark, any comment?
I just wanted to key off of one of Paula's points. Just, we're starting to see a lot of sort of cross-platform solutions. I can't think of a way to mask the name, but like the Good, and there's a couple other vendors that provide similar services across platforms as well. So that may be one way to manage kind of the complexity of it. That's really the only thought I had at this point.
All right.
It's not like a new problem, yes? It has been already addressed.
Well, so maybe it's not a new problem, but let me continue expanding on this mm-hmm. This train of thought is, what about all those older phones? What about the older operating systems? You mentioned upgrade your operating system, but I believe some providers have a very delayed delivery for that. In an enterprise environment, that's a concern, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, give them to your kids. That's what I do. Don't use them.
Yeah, I think
it's
a lot of problems with the actual networks as well. It's the networks that are not actually delivering the updates as well. And again, that's a something that you may have to take up with the actual network.
Yeah. Okay. So if no other comments about this, what we'll do is we'll kind of move on a little bit more and ask you a little bit more specifically. So one of the things that you brought up is this whole thing about checking, periodic checks against malware. Right, the discovery process. I suspect each one of you have some kind of an effort, how you do it, when you do it. Does that also apply to this, you know, emerging environment of devices that come and go on your network too? What do you do to discover malware on a network?
On the enterprise level or
everybody
back home?
Has something
or?
To say.
General, I'd say this is just as broad stroke as possible. Andy?
Yeah. I'm more of a people person. So I would probably say from an enterprise perspective, you need some kind of management tool. Again, if it's you need to control your data, you need to manage your data somewhere in the background.
Right.
So that you want to essentially keep the data isolated from the phone somehow. I think that's probably the safest way.
Sounds like data classification. Yeah. Marcus?
Yeah. I was just thinking about that. Keep it away from the phone. Whenever you're going to use it on the phone, it's going to be on the phone, yeah, however you virtualize it.
Yeah.
Anyhow, my take on antivirus solutions. The problem for me is I'm part of a team where we do a lot of reverse engineering and research and stuff, and I see how easy it is to circumvent any antivirus solution today. I mean, to be honest, it is so easy to create a unique specimen of a malware.
Yeah.
It is so damn easy. So you have to be proactive. The solution for me, I mean, I'm not saying you should stop using antivirus software, but you have to look at them for what they are. They are spam filters. It's like the spam filter in your email inbox. You can still get things through. I mean, but it will take away the vast majority of crap, so fine, keep using it. I mean, we may in the future move into a different space. I mean, we've been trying to talk about app locker and things like that forever, like whitelisting, but I mean, it's a complex question because malware is not just binaries. It's always in scripting and all that stuff. But my take is be proactive. Use antivirus, but be proactive. Doesn't matter if it's on the enterprise level or back home. All the usual suspects, keep it updated. Think about what you're downloading and executing. Think of where you're browsing on the web, all the normal stuff. Use low privs when you're on the internet. That will actually be more effective than an antivirus solution if you measure them against each other. Mm-hmm. Cross my heart, hope to die.
User education.
Yeah. User education?
Yeah. User education and in general, be comfortable what operating system is all about. Doesn't matter if it's Linux or Windows or whatever. The concept is more or less the same. We need to have things that are going, which is going to be services. If something is going on like continuously, maybe it's a service, maybe it's a driver, maybe it's something going through export or exit, maybe it's something in a memory, maybe it's like unsigned DLL somewhere. So the scope that we are monitoring, it's very limited because operating system, this is it, yes? You cannot go above it because operating system is just a piece of code. Of course, I'm simplifying that a little bit, but as long as we understand how things are working, as Marcus said, then we are able to mitigate the problem. Of course, not everything, yes? So we've got some undiscovered things. We've got rootkits that are also hard to discover, and all the things around that. But that's why whenever we are combining all the measurement mechanism all together, like antivirus, understanding, periodical check, comparing, for example, state of configuration, like Friday, and verifying if there is something new, maybe we could also play, and there are solutions available on the market as well. You can even create your own solution. We created our own solutions, for example, for that, to verify that the sums of files on the server and compare it. If there is something changed, let's understand why. Yes, we did that. That's reasonable, but we haven't done that. So this kind of concepts, and when we combine all together that concept, of course it's not everything, but it's going to be more than the basics.
And one thing I would add, because you open it up to all malware and how do you find it, the first thing that I would say is that you have to find out whether you care if there's malware there or not, because ultimately if you look across an enterprise, I've worked with some global multinationals who, they just stopped counting compromised hosts. They started counting which botnets have active hosts in their network, simply because of the volume. When you talk about hundreds of thousands of hosts, or even 10 or 20,000, and users are browsing all sorts of internet sites, they might be hitting a compromised watering hole site, or various other types of risks, just, you know, phishing, generic run-of-the-mill stuff. There's going to be a high volume of stuff, and you're never going to get to 100% clean. And, you know, there is a due diligence factor. You got to have a basic antivirus, keep it up to date, and that'll keep most of the crud out, so you're down to the more interesting things. But you got to look at the hosts. So is this just a secretary that doesn't have access to a lot of sensitive data? Is it just a PC there or a phone for that person? Or is this one of your key researchers that's developing your next product? And you really, really care about malware on the second case, but you don't really care as much on the first case. So you have to kind of look at it from the perspective of you will never be 100% clean. But you can do your due diligence to make sure everybody's as clean as they should be at a minimum, and then within the rest of it, okay, what is important to me? What is important to my business? And protect that and focus your effort, your malware, your cleanup efforts in that area. That's whether it's a device, whether it's a Windows PC, whatever it happens to be. That's how we approach malware when we look at it from a cybersecurity team perspective.
I was going to add just one addition there. The thing about mobile devices as well is, in many cases, would bring your own device. It's your device. And in many cases, the kids, your family, and it's not just you that have got access to that phone. For example, iPhones, iPads, whatever. Your kids are downloading games on it. You're not often aware of what they're downloading. So I think it's important that, you know, if it's a super secret data or very, very sensitive data, that you've actually got to say, okay, are we actually going to endorse bring your own device, or are we going to provide a physical device for our users which will be secure?
Off of one of the things Mark said is, do you guys care where the attacks are coming from? Where?
Yeah, of course we care about it.
Do you do anything about it?
I'm a consultant. I get paid for investigating that. So, yeah, we care a lot.
Tell us a little bit about what you think about the types of attackers today. Is there a different behavior that you're seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a movement in skill set and a movement in focus. Absolutely. I mean, just the last couple of years, I mean, you all heard about Stuxnet and all those more large-scale attacks that were heavily planned and executed in a very professional manner. I mean, we see a lot of that today, and it's still, what can I say, it's very easy to break into most enterprises. Like you're saying, if everybody's got malware, that means you have compromised the client on the internal network. You're way past all the firewalls and stuff, and if we look in reality, I mean, I'm out there. I also, you know, investigate those large companies all over the world, me and my team, and there's no real segmentation within those networks. When you get the hold of some computers and you extract secrets and you use dependencies, you compromise the entire domains. When you compromise domains, you compromise anything, everything. So it's a little bit hard for me, because you're a smart guy, and I want to agree with the fact that we should accept some level of problem, but I think we're accepting it right now. I don't think we should, to be honest. I don't think we should accept this. We need to find a new model. It's going to take time. It's going to be painful. But it's not acceptable that people are running code within our enterprises where we're doing our research, produce our products, and all that stuff. It will eventually affect things in a way that will be more, way more expensive than keeping our networks up to date.
Just to clarify, what I meant was we have to accept some level of risk in the network.
Risk,
within a contained network that does have that separation where if you pop a workstation, you don't get domain admin, you don't get server admin. So within an environment that has those containment pieces is the time to accept risk, or an appropriate venue to accept risk.
I agree, but I also work with military sites and all that stuff, and if you only rely on one barrier, that is a bigger risk than most people think. So you need more barriers. If there's only, like, okay, we have malware all over the office network, but we don't have any malware on the secret network, well, there will be interaction. There just will be. And if it's not today, somebody will come up with a new feature to interact and be more efficient tomorrow. So every time we move back a little bit our defenses, we still have a problem. So I don't have the answer. We need to think about this. Is it acceptable? Should we maybe make a bigger effort of changing things? That's all I'm saying.
Paula, Andy, either of you?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that now we are living in a times that malware is pretty much with the same concept, because operating system mechanism, they haven't really changed much. So it's all the same, all about the same things. But the scale has changed and the value has changed. And we've got, like, as a role, a little bit more money, and a couple of things are a little bit more meaningful. So the goal is really precious. And that's why we, as Marcus said, Stuxnet, that's why we got Duke of Flame and other pieces of malware. What I wanted to say as well is that Stuxnet is, I mean, the time, Stuxnet was in 2010. Yes, now we've got 2013. And we are still mentioning some small piece of malware that did a couple of things in Iran. And we are mentioning it because it was the first and the biggest breach the first concept that appeared in the world that everybody puts their eyes on, and we started to analyze it. We started to understand what is going on. And I think that we should never forget about Stuxnet, because I treat Stuxnet as a perfect piece of malware, the eye-opener, what can happen in the world. And pretty lately, there was some news that Stuxnet was not in 2010, but before, and it's not really hard to believe in that. Of course, malware was already there, and we just need to keep our eyes open on all the mechanisms that malware can use. So the points of entry from the malware perspective, they're all the same. Humans, some technical mechanisms, they're all the same, but the scale and the value is a little bit different.
So now that particular scenario was USB stick-based, I believe.
For example.
So what do you do about USB sticks in a corporation?
My favorite answer to that question is to put the chewing gum in the USB port. That's what I do.
I guess you chew a lot of gum. Anybody? USB sticks on CorpNet?
Restrict it with group policies. That's the simplest thing. Change your corporate security policy. You know, I think information, people need to know the dangers. And I think in many cases, people just are not aware of the dangers. And again, we're all you're talking about an internal organization, but again, you're also looking at bring your own device. You're talking about access through cloud. The attack vector is now so much larger. And the problem is that we're no longer just dealing with kids or script kiddies. These are professionals, government-sponsored, state-sponsored type of attacks. And, we point to the Chinese, but it's obviously just not the Chinese, the Americans. Everybody's involved in this. And we're just at a whole new level now. And how do you defend against that? How can you defend against that type of attack?
USB stick management,
interrupt you.
That's something that can be, of course, enforced through group policy, and that's a very nice helper. You can prevent installation of the devices and so on based on the hardware IDs of the certain devices. But, of course, you can change a hardware ID, yes? So that's just bringing the subject to another level. Of course, we can protect it, but what if somebody changes the hardware?
But it raises the bar. There's a big difference between someone that can get a USB stick that has a faked out device ID on your network and one that can't. There's a lot of money, a lot of sophistication involved, and this is where you need to raise that risk temperature up. There's, like I said, you need to accept some risk, but that doesn't mean you accept all risk all the time. You just have to find the right temperature and the right level for your organization at the time.
So does that mean you never accept a USB stick from anybody ever again?
Well, I think we shouldn't exaggerate the risk of USB sticks. I mean, we need to think about what we're afraid of.
Yeah.
I mean, there are company policies everywhere that we don't allow USB sticks anymore. I mean, you're still browsing the internet, uploading, downloading files.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on. You need to compare and see what's the biggest problem. I mean, a USB stick is a great tool if you want to transfer data from A to B, and you don't have internet connectivity, and you don't have the services to transport it.
You know, this will date me, but I think they used to be called floppy disks at one time.
I'm that old too. Anyhow, in Stuxnet, they had a zero-day vulnerability,
and
the LNK exploit that in Explorer that made it possible to put a USB stick in there and execute code on the system. That is not around anymore. It's patched. So the only threat, unless you still allow, auto run and you don't have any security configuration at all, is if somebody has a new zero-day vulnerability for example, Explorer, or for the drivers that will load the USB stick. So that is a high bar. The other problem with USB sticks is obviously data. You can put data on them and just make, it's an easy way to make the data leave the company. But we need to think about what it is. I am a little bit concerned with, every time people attend sessions and somebody say, well, beware of the USB sticks, then they go take all the USB sticks away and they don't realize that maybe there's some other thing they should do instead.
Yeah, it's a lot easier for an attacker to write a piece of malware that is, then they go and infect a watering hole. Does everybody know what that term means? So a watering hole is basically where someone goes frequently. So if you guys go to a certain site and you're always going there for code, for updates, for technical support and tips and such like that, the bad guys targeting you would go and they would go infect that website, and then they'll get to your computer through that. That's a much easier attack for an attacker to do from any country in the world than to deliver a physical USB stick. So I completely agree with you there. You have to look at, you know, what's the level of targeting that you're going to be dealing with, the sophistication. And is USB stick the top of the list, or is it more like 8 out of 10 to worry about?
And if you want to infect that website, maybe you don't even have to hack it. Maybe you can just buy a banner on that site and put JavaScript on it and stuff. So,
a cheap entry.
Yeah, if they read USA Today and you buy a banner there, then...
Yeah, and the problem that you mentioned with data, we're wondering about all the security things that that can happen, like malware or whatever. But if, as long as the user can copy data, anybody else can copy data as well. On my session on tomorrow, I'm going to show one thing. The USB stick, that is basically playing a role of a keyboard because it has a keyboard chipset on it. Nothing new, nothing new. But just to show you the concept that if I plug in the USB stick to your device, what I care about or what I may care about, it's not to hack inside, but just to grab your document. As long as you can copy it on my USB stick, I can copy it as well. So that brings the problem of data more rather than security issues. Of course, it's important, but security, data, yes.
Andy?
Yeah, I was going to say, as a follow-on from that, you know, I very rarely use USB sticks, to be honest. It's not something I use very often. What I do use, though, is I use my phone all the time. So if obviously I get malware on my phone, what's the first thing you're going to do with your phone? You're going to tether it to your laptop or tether it, and that's a way into your system. So I think it goes beyond USB sticks. You have to start looking at the different types of devices. I mean, we talk about printers, you know, internet-connected printers. There's nothing to stop you. I mean, these things are internet-facing in a company. You could easily drop a piece of malware on one of these. And you're connected, you're in the network, you know? So it's not just a case of USB sticks, that it's a whole other area as well.
And how many people have antivirus on their printer OS?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a good one. All right. You know, I want to nail on, just cover one question that came up last year, and you kind of mentioned it. This was about the jailbreaking. So we had somebody in the audience ask about, well, you know, my corporate policy is we're not supposed to allow it, but we still have these broken devices on the network. What do I do? And I think, Andy, you said quit. But now, that's a year ago. So what's your recommendation this year?
I think, honestly, if you're going to bring or have BYOD on your network, as an IT administrator, you need to basically say, okay, this is the types of phones that we're going to support. We're going to support up to this particular level. I mean, let's not forget that, you know, our cell phones, we generally keep them a couple of years. You have them 3 maximum in the US here. So realistically, you're going to cycle these phones every 2 or 3 years, and you're going to have a pretty new device. So the days of kind of having 5-year-old devices are pretty far between, unless you've given them to your kids, and they're not really then on your network
anymore.
How
often do you swap them in Scotland? Every 15th year?
No, every 2 years. Okay. You know, we're quite modern. You know, we have cars.
Oh, really? Do they have an engine?
Yeah, we do.
Let me ask you, Marcus, so what would you do? I mean, seriously, you go into a customer account, and you discover that they have jailbroken devices. What's your recommendation to that customer at that point?
Well, it obviously depends on the customer. I mean, it depends on their needs and their policies and all that stuff. But what I can say is we're working with the large bank. It's one of the biggest projects we were ever involved in. And it's kind of interesting because it relates to the same issue. They are multi-sourcing. They have, I think, 30 different openings to other companies, and they have direct VPNs and stuff so that they can communicate and share data and share services. So they asked us to do a penetration test of all their exposures. And that for me would be like 30 penetration tests, like times a couple of weeks of work. It was too big. I said, well, this is not the way to do it. We're going to find a lot of holes and problems, but it's not going to fix whatever you want to fix. You need to think differently. If this is how you're structured, you're going to have to rethink what your environment is. It is part of the internet. It is an untrusted environment. So what you need to do is come up with some kind of segmentation that works for you in this scenario. So We're actually implementing. It's been a project that has lasted for 2 years. It's very close to goal now. But we're using IPsec on all the servers, and not just domain isolation, server isolation, IPsec everywhere. So in that environment, when you bring your own device in there, you're not going to be able to communicate with anything. If you can get the right certificate on there, you may be able to communicate with some other people. Not only clients, because everybody's got the firewall on, because they don't allow inbound traffic because they're clients. I mean, you can get to the client publishing resources, maybe. You can never get to backend. So all the SQL Server, all the backend system, they have IPsec policies. They only communicate with frontends and admin stations. That's all they do. It's been painful, but it's been a great project, and we have a lot of documentation regarding that project, how we have gone about all the issues. We have filed a lot of bugs to Microsoft in, you know, when you're going that granular. And this is, we're talking about a bank with thousands and thousands of servers and thousands of clients. But they're doing it. It's happening. They're actually well prepared for the future. Of course, there are going to be legacy devices and stuff that they need to handle, but then they will have something facing them so that they can connect to that web server that will give them some services because they have that device. So that's my take on it. Be proactive.
Paula, jailbroken devices.
Yeah, so the first thing that I would like to figure out in that kind of situation is what you can do with a certain device. Yes, it might be jailbroken, but on the other hand, you may not really reach some super secret or business related information. So it's very important to understand what do we need to do with that certain phone. Maybe that the jailbroken phone provides you some functionality that is needed by business, yes? And at some point you're not really accessing a certain information. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is I'm on the same page, so you need to, whenever you are accessing this kind of data, put some segmentation in a network so that you will actually define where people with a phone that is jailbroken can get to and what is important for them. So it's again, I mean, there is nothing kind of bad in it as long as you know what you are doing and as long as you know the business value. Maybe you don't care. Somebody that gets the document, okay, that's fine. So this is what you said at the beginning, yes? So whatever has a value for us, then we put appropriate security measurements. So we cannot be really paranoid, but of course it's bad. Yeah.
I'm just going to add to what I said earlier. You want to know what the simplest and coolest thing is if you want to have office network where you don't have to care about bring your own device stuff? Direct access.
Yeah.
I mean, you can use that internally. Just redefine your office network. Call them internet and give them internet access. Yeah, anybody can join. Doesn't matter. You can have guests in there. You can just go on your internal network, plug into the wall. That is a high bandwidth site. That's what it is. So you can access your resources. But you can actually have direct access gateways internally facing your clients.
Mark,
I was going to add one more thing there. I was going to say, you know, penetration testing, you know, a lot of customers pay for that. It's expensive and it's very, very worthwhile doing. But one of the things that you've got to do is when they present the report to you, you've got to act on that. It's amazing how many customers a year later, you go back and you see the same vulnerabilities, you see the same issues purely because they haven't acted on it. And how can you, you know, the ball is very much in their court in that case. So act on what's found.
Mark, anything about jailbroken devices?
The way I view a jailbroken device is it just becomes fundamentally easier for an attacker to attack it, especially if you start from the assumption that it was a Windows device or an Apple device where there's a really good control of the device and the applications on it. The Androids I'm not as familiar with. I know that there's a range of variation there. But ultimately, when you jailbreak that device, you take those protections that vendor and the carrier and everybody else put in that says you must pass this bar to get arbitrary code on there, whether it's good apps or whether it's malware or whether it's a Trojan app that is disguised as a good app.
I was just going to add, that's a really important point, what you just said. You said, I'm not familiar with that. Yep. That's something that if you are going to support bring your own device, you need to be familiar with all of the platforms. You need to know what their security is on these devices. How can you support them if you're not aware of those?
Yep. And then ultimately, when you do that jailbreaking, that's lowering the bar. That makes it a lot easier for an attacker to get on there, and it makes it a lot easier to get an app on there. So when you do that, it's like saying, okay, well, we've got a Windows 8 PC where someone is running only as a standard user, and you've just taken it down to a Windows XP machine where they're running as an admin. You've just lowered that down equivalently. And you really do, and you guys may have noticed, I'm talking about PCs and about devices interchangeably. They're both powerful. They have RAM. They have storage. They have data. They have credentials. They have access to your network. You need to view devices and PCs in a very similar fashion and think of them and the risk levels that, you'll accept on them in about the roughly the same way. Of course, there's different antivirus products, there's different capabilities, but you really kind of need to look at all these things as potential threats. They're all valid ways in.
Yeah, the Android platform as a platform is actually pretty robust. It's a good platform, and it's got some really good security features. Again, if you implement them correctly, and if you don't jailbreak things, they're as good as any other platform.
All right, so this is an opportunity. If you have questions, we'll start fielding the questions, so grab one of the mics. Otherwise, we'll continue. Let me ask you, panelists, pass the hash. There's been a lot of talk about it. You want to give me your perspective on pass the hash?
Yeah.
Marcus.
I mean, the company that I work at, we have created some of the tools that are among the most popular tools in the world to use those techniques. And what can I say? I mean, passing the hash, the concept, if you don't know what the concept is you take hashes from one system. So the assumption is you compromise one system, and that system will contain secrets. It can be just the secrets that belongs to the user that is logged on, for example, which will not be a problem unless that user also has access to other systems. So imagine this is a regular user. He doesn't have any authority over the network. Well, you can still get to his data. But if a domain admin, for example, or some service admin, IT support guy has been logged on previously, then you can extract his hash as well. It may still be there. Or you can monitor it until he logs on next time. When you have that hash, you don't have to crack it and get the clear text password. You can actually use the hash to connect to other systems directly. And again, I mean, there are new tools out there. One is called Mimikatz.
That's my team is working on.
Your team is working on it. Anyhow, the Mimikatz, maybe you want to talk about it then. How it works?
No problem.
Sure.
So in Mimikatz, you've got several functionalities, and now the new version is coming. And you can, for example, extract passwords that are stored in so-called LSA secret. In many places, of course, in operating system one, it's a memory that is used by local security authorities of system. Another one is in the scheduled tasks. Another functionality that you've got in Mimikatz allows to, for example, dump hashes from the dumps. So the memory dumps that are made whenever, for example, you got an operating system crash. Another possibility is to get the password from the credentials manager. Another possibility is to get the password, for example, from a registry, and that's the place that service accounts are storing password. And the concept is very, very obvious, I would say, and they are storing passwords because, for example, whenever you are running service on a domain account, whenever your computer is, for example, disconnected from the network, the service must be still up and running. And that's the concept why it's actually looking like that. That's why we need to have it stored somewhere to use it. So that kind of brings the problem that, of course, can be mitigated. And that's what Marcus was discussing, that whenever, for example, that privilege account is logging into a certain workstation, then you can grab all the information that this person left. So, for example, the hash and so on. And you can use that hash and, as Marcus mentioned, pass it somewhere. Because in operating system, you've got several places in which you can basically authenticate using some parameters. And one of the parameters that are possible to be used is actually a user's hash, not necessarily the password. So there are many functions that are taking those, and that's why pass the hash is actually possible.
And just to clarify from a language standpoint, The hash that's being discussed is not just any old hash. This is a hash of the password. This is direct, I want to say it's an MD4, I'd have to look it up to be 100% sure, of the password itself. So this is essentially the equivalent of the password from the computer standpoint, and it's just used to authenticate in a number of fashions. So it's much like stealing and reusing a password. It's just another form of that.
I mean, the point I was trying to make is we shouldn't limit the discussion only to hashes, because when you have that access to a system so you can extract hashes, the authentication packages, for example, the ones that will allow for digest authentication, will actually store clear text passwords as well. So the clear text password will also be there. So the problem is not that the fact that they're there. If they only belong to the user that only has rights to that system, you are still system in order to be able to extract them. If you can only use them for that system, then it's fine. The problem is when it comes to dependencies. So if those secrets stored there can access other resources that are more important, that's when you have a problem. So what are the solutions? I mean, there is a paper that was recently released from Microsoft. I agree with a lot of things in that paper, but there is actually one feature that is way better than the ones they are suggesting in that paper. That is a Microsoft feature. And I was in Seattle discussing that with one of the writers of that paper, and he didn't even know about it. And it's called Authentication Mechanism Assurance. And it has to do with smart cards. If you put a smart card in a computer normally, it will just generate that hash. It will do it will log on using the password, and the hash will be presented in the system. But the idea with authentication mechanism assurance is that you can attach a string to the smart card template. So whoever has a smart card from that template can actually become a member of a dynamic group because of that link between the template and the group Active Directory groups. That gives you a new possibility. You can actually say that only members of this dynamic group can access those resources, or they are the domain admins. And that means that if you log on using that particular smart card, you will become a member of the group that can do domain administration, for example. If you steal the hash and you don't have the smart card, you will log on, but you will not be a member of that group. That is an essential difference. And the reason Microsoft implemented it was because they want to give you different levels of assurance and access to data. But you can as well use it. It's completely backward compatible because you will only get group membership. So you can use it to do administrative tasks as well. I think it's really, really interesting. And Hassan sitting there, my colleague, is one of the gurus in that department. So if you want to talk more about that, talk to the wolf.
All right, so let's take a question here, just to bring at least one question into the conversation. Mike over here? No?
Okay, I think it's on now. I've actually got a list of things. Marcos, we will want to talk to you. By the way, regarding Pass the Hash, my name's Aaron Margosis. Mark Simos and I are doing a talk tomorrow. We're two of the co-authors of that white paper that Marcos just trashed in front of everybody.
This is one of my old heroes, so I'm going to have to make a snappy comeback here. There were a lot of good information in that paper. I'm just saying that was not there. I think there are a lot of good points there, and I'm not saying that because you're you. I do love you, but that was a good paper.
So as a co-author, we can have a follow-up conversation and dive in that much more deeper.
In the back.
We've actually got a talk tomorrow. Mark and I are presenting tomorrow about that white paper, 5 o'clock tomorrow, somewhere in the convention center. I'll find out before I get there, I'm sure. I will want to talk to you about that solution and find out, does this require an add-on to Windows? Because one of the things we wanted to do within this white paper was not add any dependencies for our customers that you must acquire this other thing, or whether it's open source or not, or free or not, that within Windows you can accomplish these mitigations. And so that's what one of the things we were trying to do.
There are no external dependencies, but you do have to do one thing that Microsoft will actually appreciate. You will need modern operating systems. So mechanism assurance, and correct me if I'm wrong, is Windows Server 2008 R2. But then if you don't want to buy smart cards, and that's the third party thing, right? Then you can use the virtual smart cards coming out of Windows 8 and Windows Server 2012. So
somebody back there likes the virtual smart cards.
So, I mean, you're going to have to use a new software. I mean, you're not going to solve this tomorrow. But looking at the future, those are the great solutions that Microsoft is actually providing that can mitigate this. But they weren't invented just because for that reason. So that's why I'm stressing it.
Okay. Is it okay if I make some other comments?
All right. Let give you one more, and then we'll move on.
You should be in the panel, man. You're in the wrong place.
Aaron, I think it refused, actually.
Yeah. Sorry. So very quick comment, then a bigger comment. Stuxnet, I'm a huge fan of it. It was freaking awesome. It wasn't perfect, though, because if it were, we would never have heard of it. It leaked. The other thing I wanted to talk about regarding BYOD and the concept that what's inside your network and 100% managed is more secure. The thing is that what I see in my accounts all the time is managing PCs is not a panacea, because I always see my customers managing, quote unquote, their PCs by insisting on older versions of Java staying installed, which is just a gateway right in, failing to install patches on a timely basis, granting and using excess privileges, undisciplined use of domain admin accounts, using privilege escalation tools, et cetera. And so you can end up with something where your whitelisted device, whether it's an Apple or a Windows Phone or a Windows RT, where you can't install all that other stuff, may be more secure than your quote-unquote managed PCs.
So managed PCs, I guess that's the question is...
I totally agree with you. I mean, if I am doing a penetration test today, and I know that I'm going to target these individuals, I'm going to do a client-side attack, to me, it's going to be easier to hit their PCs than it's going to be to hit their mobile devices. For sure, I wouldn't even think about that today. So I think we're like exaggerating the problem. I mean, they will eventually become the same, more or less. But I totally agree. A managed system is still a PC where you can do a lot of things on your own. So absolutely, good point.
Thank you, Aaron. So let's shift the conversation a little bit. Now, thanks to all of these problems, I know our governments, every single one of our governments are stepping in and trying to add some laws and regulations about disclosure and just general information availability. In fact, actually, now there's some new laws too, like CISPA and SOPA. Fantastic mechanisms to try to encourage organizations to behave better, or are they? Your positions on a little bit more on the ethereal issues of things like CISPA, SOPA, HIPAA. Andy?
I mean, these laws are not just US-based. I mean, we've got laws in the UK as well. Some people call them semi-draconian. Germany's got laws, you know. The whole concept of this is obviously protecting IP, intellectual property rights, which in the digital world is getting very, very difficult these days. And there's the big argument from groups like Anonymous and other hacking groups saying, no, hang on a minute, you're trying to steal my, you're taking away my freedom by blocking websites such as the Pirate Bay, sorry, Marcus. You know, by blocking these types of websites, you're actually stopping me downloading, you know, free movies and free music. And again, I don't honestly believe that this has anything to do with personal freedom. So it's inevitable these types of laws are going to come in because, you know, companies are going to want to protect their stuff somehow. And I think these laws are coming in. Again, we're in a different world than we were in 20 years ago. You know, we've you know, had terrorist attacks. So in the UK, at the moment, they're talking about new laws that will allow the monitoring of everybody's email, internet usage. Now, not actually the actual content, but more or less the IP addresses, the phone numbers, where it's going, who it's going to and from. Again, that's something I don't entirely agree with. I think that is going too far.
The boiling of the frog.
Indeed.
The what?
The boiling of the frog. You cook him slowly. So
oh, I
first
see.
First they just want the heathers, then some more.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you put it in boiling water, it's going to jump out. I mean, that's what I was told when I was 10 years old in a biology class. So
yeah.
If you heat it up, it's going to stay there until it dies.
Okay.
It's a business strategy. It's a very common one.
Fantastic. I love it. I'll think about that. Next time I boil
Google's
a frog, I'll think about
strategies.
You.
They're pretty successful. So they give you, piece by piece, they take your privacy.
Paula, any comments about privacy?
I can cook a frog for you if you want to.
Yeah, I would love to.
I'm not French, but I can try.
Here we go. So regarding this law regulation, so I think it's personally, I think it's a very good idea, but A, it's very expensive. So implementation of it will take years and years and years. So this is the first thing. Second thing is, as long as we have that discussion going on, it's good because everybody's going to pay attention to the certain things. Regarding, for example, myself, whenever I'm using some pictures and so on, I always make sure that I do have appropriate rights for those. So you've got iStock photo, you've got different pearls, starting from the easiest principle here. I always buy them, either I check out if I can use them for free. So that's something that opened my eye as well. Like several years ago, it was not even an issue. You've got all the torrents, you've got all the like photos available in the internet, and I even saw once a presentation on a pretty big conference in which person was presenting a photo with this cross from iStock photo, don't copy.
don't copy this image. Copy, oh yeah,
really.
Right.
I was like, really? So it just of course happened, and that keeps our eyes open and our minds open for that. And I think it's a little bit too early, because it costs a lot of money to implement that kind of mechanisms. But still, as long as somebody thought about it, it's good, because we're going to continue probably in that discussion.
Mark?
So the way I see the laws is sometimes, and this is just a general comment on laws, not on those specific ones, sometimes the laws just kind of follow along with, okay, we finally got these best practices down to where the lawmakers feel comfortable. They can, you know, write it down and call it, and boom, it's set, and that's the new base that we're working from to build from. Because security is always gooey. We're always exploring the new territory. We set up a system, the bad guys hack it. We set up an approved system, the bad guys hack it. It's this constant race that we're always doing. There's just no way around that. You throw in all the BYOD and all these new technologies and the fact that what used to be a boundary is now a permeable thing where data and security passes in and out. So the law is always sort of, in one respect, catching up there. And sometimes they set out principles that force technology to sort of adjust to it, and so they get out in front. When you take a look at like the German privacy laws are just legendary. And those cause changes in technology and force us to adjust to them. Sure. So that's kind of how I see the laws shaping out in most cases.
I was just going to ask the audience, actually, just with a show of hands, raise your hand if you've never downloaded a movie or a piece of music. One person.
You got 4 or 5 there.
Yeah. Okay, who's never downloaded illegal movies? Wow. You're all bad guys. Okay. I was going to say, maybe a different way to look at it. We were doing an event, myself and Paula were doing an event in the Netherlands recently. And in the Netherlands, any Dutch people in the audience?
Yeah.
A couple
okay.
of Dutch people.
So in the Netherlands, they take a very different stance on it. What they do is for every storage device, every USB drive, every hard drive, every DVD-ROM, everything, they charge a tax on that. Because and then they say you can download whatever you want. It's illegal to upload, but it's not illegal to download, and that's how they recoup the taxes.
So use it, just don't sell it.
Sweden is even better. We actually have the same tax, and we still get fined if we steal the film. So,
yeah,
good business model.
All right, we have a question over here.
I'd like the panel's reaction to an announcement by two scientists yesterday who are going to present at the Black Hat conference, who said that they can they have developed a technique that will allow them to ship malware into mobile devices using power bricks, the power connections and power bricks. And I was wondering what your reaction to that was.
Oh, that sounds juicy.
Weren't they mentioning that it was for an iPhone only?
Yeah, there has to be some intelligence that somehow is connected to the operating system. I mean,
I would say cool, but I would love to see it, so yeah. I'm really waiting for that.
So I guess stay tuned. We're going to have to watch what happens in Black Hat.
Yeah.
So for all of you that attend, I guess you'll have to let us know. These people will know.
But as far as I remember, maybe I'm wrong, correct me please if I'm wrong, but this was for an iPhone phone, yes?
Yeah. I mean, the new charger is probably, I mean, I'm not read up on this at all, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
If there's a new communication channel because you want to have intelligence, you want to know how much power the charger will give you and that stuff, if you can send data to it, it's just software. If there are flaws in it, you can probably break it. Mm-hmm. So it's nothing new, really. It's just a different channel.
That brings attention to that completely new area. And when I heard that news, I was like, yay, that's super cool, because it's still a USB. It's still a USB. Mm-hmm. So it's another way to plug in something to your phone. And when I read it, I was like, wow, that's another story that it's such an obvious thing. Yes, like with an Explorer, LMK, vulnerability, and Stuxnet. Wow, I will never guess that whenever you open up LMK, whenever you see through Explorer.exe LMK, it actually loads the code that it points to. It's brilliant. Mm.
I think a brilliant delivery platform for malware, by the way, is a law enforcement tool. It's called FinSpy, and FinSpy basically it works at the ISP level, and basically a piece of malware is dropped or advertised to the user's phone. For example, it might be an update for iTunes. Again, with something like that, it looks like it's coming from an official source, but of course it's not. And then the law enforcement have got you, basically.
All right, so let's take the question down over the end there. Hold on. Go on.
Check.
All right, we'll take this question over here, and I'll walk over to you and give my mic. Maybe.
No.
Get closer to the mic. Try to, like, swallow it.
Okay, hello. All right.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, Bob.
Very esoteric, and, you know, companies have budgets, et cetera. I work for in the public sector. One of the things we keep thinking about is using non-persistent VDI for a lot of the security. I mean, you just log off, the system completely refreshes and wipes itself and reloads itself from a new image. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is a good way to fix some of these problems, or are we just kidding ourselves?
I like that. There's a product called Deep Freeze. It's been out for years that did something like that based on a physical environment. This is really nothing new. I like it. I know a lot of public companies that are using it. And again, it's another way to isolate your physical data from the physical machine. And I think actually now with the likes of data stored in the cloud, it's actually easier. But again, nobody's mentioned the two key things, encryption, and IPsec, of course, securing, if you use these mechanisms, I think that they go hand in hand. Mark?
So I think that approach is actually very valid for sort of the front door type attacks and the get on the network, because it becomes very hard for them to get a foothold and do anything with it and to keep that for an extended period. But if the attackers are at or already using the infrastructure as a point of attack, and they're able to get to that point, they've essentially already gotten around that mechanism. Sure. And so it really depends on how you view it. I mean, the key is to use it where it makes sense, but not, you know, rely on it like this is the Maginot line or the ultimate wall that cannot be crossed.
Sure.
I'm thinking about how volatile the data is going to become, because, I mean, you still want to store your profiles and stuff. You don't want to do a lot of work and then throw everything away as soon as you leave the computer. So there's probably going to be, you know, a profile, shared folder stuff where you can still access. So you need to think about that implementation, what you really want to accomplish, and how you're really going to configure it. Mm.
All right, so let's... Yeah, my question basically boils down to data being transferred to cloud-based storage. And, you know, we've got limitations on our bandwidth and our network internally. But we have a good externally facing bandwidth for the internet for various things, okay? We've restricted large files on SharePoint, and of course our server shares are limited in scope and availability. So a lot of our clients have gone out to a third party storage solution that's free and unsecured, and we're trying to come up with a mechanism to manage and store. My concern is, you know, we've got intellectual property that's being put out on basically the internet in this cloud-based storage solution, and trying to explain to our clients, yes, well, you can't email it because you only have a 5 meg limit. You can't store it on SharePoint because you have a 50 meg limit. So if you have a 150 meg file you want to share with one of your buddies, basically you've got to either forklift it to them on a USB stick, which again we have restrictions on. How do you see this kind of being able to have a limited environment yet still be able to share files across a large infrastructure? Because basically we have 72 locations, 26 different countries around the world, but very restricted bandwidth between them.
I was going to say, first of all, I would avoid some of the free services. I mean, free is great, but often you don't know what you're getting. Often you don't get a service level agreement. Often they make no guarantees or no warranties to back up your data. Whereas if you go for a solid paid for solution, there are guarantees there. There's a solid service level agreement. Often there are financial benefits to that as well. You maybe get, you know, if the system went down, you're going to get your money back type of scenario. And also the actual allowances of the amount that you can store and send and upload are much higher than the free services as well. And they tend to be more secure. Marcus?
So,
Mark?
So the principle that I would adhere to, I mean, it sounds like you've made it extraordinarily difficult, you know, either through your decisions or others in your company, for them to transfer files. And if the secure thing to do is the hardest thing to do, it's not going to happen. If it's the easiest thing to do, it will. And you have to find a way, whatever meets your company security standards, to be able to transfer those large files securely. And if you provide that and you make it easy, the users will use it. If not, there's a million internet services that are trying to solve this problem in a almost exactly the same way. And they will take it and they will make it insecure. Whenever I architect a solution, it's always to that principle that you have to leverage the power of human behavior, the power of human habits, yes, the least resistance factor. And if you design it to that, people will do the secure thing. But if you don't, you're going to beat your head against the wall.
All right, so we'll take one more question and then closing comments. So
this will be just a quick question. I've been struggling with BYOD and MDM for a while now, ever since the iPad. And now I'm with Dell, and we just came out with a new MDM solution. And the question I keep getting from admins is, how do I blacklist, how do I whitelist apps and things like that? And across the board, Google, Microsoft, Apple, they have taken BYOD and they said, okay, operative word there, your. So you, the owner of the device, should have the majority of the control here. So me as a sysadmin, I can only do certain things with these certain APIs and only do certain things over the air, to do more control, I actually have to plug it into a computer, which, you know, there's vulnerabilities there. So you say, okay, so no jailbroken stuff, so we can have that safe. But as you may know, people are developing things in Android that turn on monitor mode on the antenna without actually elevating to root. So that stuff's happening now. So we have a problem. We have a catch-22. I can't pass over the air, so I have to connect to the computer, but now I'm connecting to the computer. So are you, I just want to know if the chatter you may be aware of, if this is a, are they cognizant that they're making this problem for sysadmins and maybe what they're doing about it, maybe moving towards more control from an admin perspective for mobile device management's sake?
So it comes back to, I think, the original problem. Now you have a device, you're going to tether it to fix it, or if you don't tether it, you can't fix it because you can't manage it. So what do you do? What's the answers that you give your customers? Marcus?
Well,
Andy?
I don't have the perfect answer to that question. I think we're going to have to wait and see in the future, and of course we can affect the future. But
I think you mentioned a new model, right?
Yeah, I would like to see the corporate phone model coming back. Like we used to have, like the old Windows phone that you actually had admin access and everything. I like the model back for certain scenarios, like enterprise customers and stuff. So we'll see where that goes, but I would not be too surprised if Microsoft ends up in that place eventually. Like you can have real managed devices. They do have the system center platforms in every business case in the world to integrate the mobile devices the same way they do computers. So
yeah, because if the question is about additional functionality that is actually not there, so it's more or less a discussion in between a vendor that they haven't implemented that kind of control. And I think we just need to wait. Either you just, if you are working in a big company or if you have appropriate amount of green ones, then you can develop your own solution. So that's, and I would say that's the perfect answer.
Yeah. And again, to Aram Margose's point, who was speaking earlier and asking questions, I mean, the fact that we don't have all that access to the devices actually makes them more secure.
All right, closing thoughts across the board. Andy.
Been really good, actually. Great questions today. Thanks, everybody, for your questions. Just in terms of being secure and safe, be proactive. As I say, learn about the different platforms, especially with BYOD. You know, don't stick your head in the sand and say, oh, I don't know Android. You need to learn Android. You need to learn about iPhone. You can't pretend that they don't exist out there.
Sessions this week?
Sessions, I've got two this evening. One on social networking security, another one on...
Something.
Marcus. And tomorrow as well.
Me and my colleague Hassan over there, we have one more session this week, and it's today. It's 1:15, I think, and it's in Ballroom B, just next door. It's a session about the hacker tools you should know and worry about. So it's going to be a full demo session. We're just going to throw you tool after tool after tool, just as an awareness session. It's going to be
so you'll
fun.
Be there, I'm sure. So everybody will
I'm
be
gonna
there.
I'm going to be there.
All right. Paula?
The comment from me is, have you already bought your Surface? Who has it? Surface.
Who hasn't bought their Surface yet?
Okay, so 50% of the room. Okay, so whenever you got them, or maybe you're going to get them, there is a very nice on Channel 9 series of videos. They are called Windows Defrag, and that's something that is related to Windows internals, starting from how internal parts of operating system work, ending up with actually tools, solutions, how you can monitor Windows, how you can investigate malware, and so on. So take that, put it on your Surface, and watch it on the way back home. It's really interesting, and it will, I'm pretty sure, make you a little bit more passionate about some internal mechanisms.
Sessions?
Sessions. Tomorrow at 5, unfortunately, I got also a session about hackers not halted. So all the situations that are not really, and sometimes they cannot be really well mitigated in the infrastructure that you can use to get inside, just to briefly summarize. Another session is about passwords. So all the places in which Windows stores passwords and you don't know about it.
All right, and Mark?
Wanted to thank you guys for attending today, for the great questions. And tomorrow, 5 p.m., talk
with,
about pass
with that
the hash,
guy over here, Aaron, wherever he is.
With Mr. Margosis.
Yes, yes.
Talk about what you can do with your network today and the features that you already have deployed to protect yourself against what takes less than 24 hours to get to main admin.
All right, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.